what you have now very often is people seeing Israel as a kind of personification of evil. So they'll talk about Israel as being an apartheid state, colonialism, you know, colonialist, racist, all the rest of it. And once you don't judge Israel by normal criteria, but you see it as a kind of epitome of evil, I'd say that is a form of anti-Semitism.
Coming up on British Thought Leaders, journalist and author Daniel Ben-Ami. Daniel talks about the rise of anti-Semitism since the October 7th terror attacks.
You have 67% of American 18 to 24-year-olds saying they see Jews as an oppressor class. And, you know, in the post-Second World War period, that would have been seen as horrendous by most people, that a large number of young people see Jews inherently as part of an oppressor class. But now, apparently, it's a majority view among just ordinary Americans, a cross-section of Americans. It's just absolutely horrendous.
He discusses Islamism and why it's such a threat to the Jewish people.
I see Islamism as a totalitarian movement, inherently anti-Semitic, genocidally anti-Semitic, but very different from Islam as a religion. And as I say, they see themselves as true Muslims and are very, very hostile to other Muslims who don't go along with their view.
Welcome to British Thought Leaders. I'm Lee Hall. Today I'm sitting down with journalist and author Daniel Ben-Ami. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Since the October 7th terror attacks, we've seen Britain divided into ways we haven't really seen before, and anti-Semitism has become more apparent. It was quite a surprise to a lot of people, but I mean, you've been doing your Radicalism of Fools project since 2021. I mean, were the divides and the anti-Semitism a surprise to you?
Not the divides themselves, but the extent of them has surprised me a bit. So, in fact, I set up the Radicalism of Fools in response to a conflict between Israel and Hamas in May 2021, which was obviously, the scale was much, much less than the scale now. But already I was looking at social media, and you had things like social justice warrior types talking about Jews being child killers, you know, as if it's in the nature of Jews to want to kill children. That was their, what they were saying. And it wasn't just a tiny number of people. It was still a small minority, but a significant number of people. And I began to think, oh, hold on a minute. Anti-Semitism is becoming a serious problem here. So it's obviously become a bigger problem since then. And the extent of it has surprised me to some extent, but it wasn't completely out of the blue.
What does the Radicalism of Fools refer to?
Well, the original saying that it's based on is the idea that the socialism of fools. Right. And that came out of the late 19th century in Germany and Austria, where you got some left-wingers, and the left-wing movements at the time were very, very big in Central Europe, in Germany, Austria, and so on. You got some of them being anti-capitalist, and you know they're entitled to be anti-capitalist if they want, but associating capitalism with Jews. So saying capitalism somehow had a kind of Jewish character to it. So obviously I have no problem if people are worried, say, about unemployment or inequality, that's fine, that's up to them. But when they start talking about the Jewish character of capitalism, to me that would have been a very wrong way to see it. So to their credit, there were some German socialist leaders who were saying, this isn't genuine socialism, this is a socialism of fools. Right. But I've kind of updated that because now you have different forms of anti-Semitism. So, for example, you have Islamist anti-Semitism, by which I mean anti-Semitism associated with Islamist movements like the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas, for example. You have, obviously, you still have the kind of right-wing, far-right kind of anti-Semitism, although I think in most countries it's pretty small. And then you have what is sometimes called left-wing anti-Semitism, but I think it's a bit misleading because I think it's different historically from what the left was. So from what I've already said, you can see I think there were problems with the left historically. But I think what we have now is something different. So the Radicalism of Fools really refers to these different kind of movements which see themselves as really radical, but blame Jews, or not just blame Jews, but see Jews as kind of epitomising all of these kind of problems that exist in the world.
We see a lot of opposition to what Israel is doing. Do you How do we kind of understand the mixture of anti-Semitism and just kind of politics in that?
I think at least in principle, it's fairly straightforward to draw the line, because if people say, I really sympathise with the Palestinians, I think that's absolutely fine. If people want to be critical of the Israeli government, I think that's absolutely fine in principle. But I think what you have now very often is people seeing Israel as a kind of personification of evil. So they'll talk about Israel as being an apartheid state, colonialism, you know, colonialist, racist, all the rest of it. And once you don't judge Israel by normal criteria, but you see it as a kind of epitome of evil, I'd say that is a form of anti-Semitism. And one striking example of that I came across the other day was that evidently, if you look at the resolutions of the United Nations, the General Assembly last year, Israel was condemned twice as much as all the other countries put together. So the 193 members of the United Nations, so Israel, one country, one relatively small country, was criticised as much as the 192 other countries. Now, of those 192 other countries, I think none of them are perfect. I think that's not a controversial thing to say. Some of them are very, very flawed. But to argue that Israel is as bad as all of the 192 put together in terms of its faults, to me, shows there's something very skewed and wrong about the discussion.
One of the key pillars of your project is free speech. A lot of people would say, we ban anti-Semitism, it's hate speech, no one is allowed to say it. Yeah. Why do you feel free speech is important in this context?
I mean, I think there are two reasons. I think one is just in principle. I think free speech is an important principle. And if people have bad ideas, those ideas should be challenged rather than suppressed. But I think there's also a practical question, which I think the whole anti-Semitism debate illustrates very well. Because if you ban people from saying anti-Semitic things by using abusive words for Jews, for example, all that tends to happen is that it just takes a more disguised form. So anti-Semitism will take the disguised form of anti-Israel sentiment. So as I've already said, I don't think every criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic, but I think it's also true that a lot of people who are anti-Semitic frame it as anti-Zionism. And I think that's what happens. That's the kind of practical case for free speech, that if you just ban bad speech and bad words, it just comes, it doesn't go away because it's not being challenged. In fact, it probably undermines the fight to challenge it. It just comes back in a more kind of coded form.
I wanted to get your thoughts as an expert on anti-Semitism on the mainstream media. What kind of role do you think it is playing in this situation?
I think it goes along with the general problems of the mainstream media. I think what is sometimes called woke ideas, I don't particularly like the term woke, but the kind of those identity politics assumptions are very common among journalists. Obviously there are exceptions. I'm not accusing all journalists of being like that, but very common in the mainstream media. We're not talking about the fringes of the media. So for example, the kind of identity politics assumptions that you have a hierarchy of oppression, that white people have privilege, and from that many do draw the conclusion that Jews are somehow privileged and Israel is a country that exemplifies privilege. So because the mainstream media often embraces those ideas, I think that often leaves it predisposed to some of these anti-Semitic arguments.
Can we talk a bit more about the identity politics side of things? I mean, how does this progressivism feed into the contemporary anti-Semitism?
Yeah, well, I think it's probably the newest form of anti-Semitism, and it is very problematic. And I think you have to look at its assumptions, which I began to do before. So really, you have the idea that you have this hierarchy of oppression, that white people are inherently privileged, that people of colour, as they're called, or oppressed people at the bottom of the hierarchy, are kind of always destined to be at the bottom. Maybe they can kind of mitigate their position to some extent, but they're destined to be at the bottom. And then people often draw the conclusion that Jews, because they're very often successful, not that every Jewish person is rich, that's not true, but as a community, the Jewish community has been relatively successful, don't think we should deny that. But that's then taken not as a good thing, that migrants to different countries can be, can do well. In the past, that was seen as a good thing. But now it's seen, at least by the kind of identitarians, as a kind of mark of privilege, that they're privileged. So from there, people draw the conclusion that, or can draw the conclusion very easily, that Jews are somehow privileged, they're hyper-privileged, they should be criticised on that basis. Or on a kind of very practical level, when you have, say, the 7th of October pogrom in Israel, when Hamas and other Islamist fighters came across the border and slaughtered many, 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 many hundreds of Israelis, you draw the conclusion, if you accept the premises, which I don't, but it doesn't really count because the Israelis were kind of oppressed people. So it was somehow justified, or it doesn't really count as them being slaughtered. So that's the kind of practical outcome of it.
So as though we had this kind of progressive nature rising, and then anti-Semitism as well, and the two have kind of met and they're working together to, you know, kind of make each other worse, if you like.
Yeah, and I think Islamism, which maybe we'll come on to, plays a role in that. So by Islamism, I do mean a kind of religio-political movement. So, you know, movements like Hamas, the Muslim Brotherhood, maybe the AKP in Turkey, for example. And they have supporters in the West. And in a way, they give what, I mean, sociologists talk about a permission structure for anti-Semitism. So what they mean by that is that if you have, say, a person from, I don't know, who's from a migrant background, from maybe an Arab country or maybe Turkey or Iran or wherever, saying anti-Semitic things, then if you go back to the kind of identitarians, that then seems acceptable because they're deemed to be oppressed people and they're saying those things. Therefore, it makes it acceptable for other people, for kind of people not from a migrant background to say those things. So if you look at some of the opinion polls in America, for example, and America is just, I choose America because that's where there's most data, not because it's the only place there's a problem, but you now have, according to the latest Harvard-Harris poll, you have 67% of American 18 to 24-year-olds saying they see Jews as an oppressor class. And, you know, in the post-Second World War period, that would have been seen as horrendous by most people, that a large number of young people see Jews inherently as part of an oppressor class. But now, apparently, it's a majority view among just ordinary Americans, a cross-section of Americans. It's just absolutely horrendous from my perspective.
Focusing on those young people, another poll said nearly half of the 18 to 24-year-old Americans were just as likely to support Hamas as Israel. How do we understand these stats, and what are their implications, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I found that horrendous as well. If the question was, do you support Israel or do you support the Palestinians, that would be a bit different, because I could understand people saying, well, the Palestinians in Gaza are really suffering, which clearly they are, there's no question of that. And if they said, well, I have more sympathy for the Palestinians, then, you know, I could understand that. I'd still make the case that the conflict is more complicated than many people assume. But you can make that argument. But when they say they support Hamas, I mean, obviously, a lot of these people don't fully understand what Hamas is, but nevertheless, it's pretty clear that it's a terrorist organisation, that it can and does slaughter civilians in large numbers. So to have a very large number of young Americans, even if there's some kind of margin for error in the polls, even if there's whatever it is, half the level that they say, which I don't think that's right, but even if it was, it's still horrendous that so many people would say they support a terrorist group. It's just absolutely frightening.
If we look at social media, I mean, some of the support for Hamas and its associates on there has been enormous. There was even a wave of people supporting bin Laden's attacks on America. I mean, who or what is behind this? It must take a lot of money and a lot of time.
There is money and effort. I mean, for example, Kuwait, which, as I'm sure most of your viewers know, is this kind of tiny, I mean, geographically tiny and population-wise tiny Gulf state, but which has a lot of money, a lot of oil revenue, is putting a lot of effort into it. So evidently, Qatar is the largest foreign fund of American universities. So it's a huge, huge scale. And it's Qatar that funds, or is one of the main funders of Hamas, also funds the Al Jazeera media network, right, which is obviously very influential as well, both in English and Arabic. But I wouldn't put all of the blame on that, because I think also just the fact that identity politics is very influential and is becoming the mainstream view. It's not a kind of fringe view that a few people in the sociology department of universities have. It's becoming the mainstream elite view now. I think that that then leaves people open to saying, yes, I support Hamas because they're fighting for the oppressed against the oppressors and they're somehow progressive movements.
Moving on to Islamism, can you talk to us a bit about the difference between Islam and Islamism and why Islamism is such a threat to the Jewish people?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked that question because I think it is very, very confused and people often try and collapse the two together. So by Islam, I think that's pretty straightforward. I see that as a faith, a global faith with perhaps 2 billion people worldwide, so a large chunk of the world's population. And within Islam, obviously, it's diverse. You have Sunnis and Shiites and all sorts of subdivisions. Most, according to the opinion poll data, you know, most Muslims are not anti-Semitic. Although, if you look at the West, it tends to be, so it's important to get the balance right, that the majority are not anti-Semitic, but the on average, the number who subscribe to anti-Semitic ideas is higher than in the general population. That's just kind of empirical data. But most Muslims and the Muslim faith, I don't see as inherently anti-Semitic. Islamism is something different. It's a political movement, a religio-political movement, so it combines elements of politics and religion, that first emerged in 1928 in Egypt with the Muslim Brotherhood. That's a kind of prototype Islamist movement, and lots of other movements, including Hamas, have spun off from the Muslim Brotherhood. And it's a movement which has certain premises which are generally not in the Muslim religion. So they see the global Muslim community not just as a kind of community of faith, of believers, in the kind of Ummah, they see it as a kind of political movement. And they see their role as creating an Islamic world order that everyone has to follow. So they don't like the nation state. They're not generally loyal to the nation state. What they want is to banish the world of what they see as barbarism. They see the world in a state of, I can't speak Arabic, but Jahiliya, I think it is in Arabic, as a kind of state of pre-Islamic barbarism. And their view is that the true Muslims, because they see themselves as true Muslims, they don't see a lot of Muslims as true Muslims from their perspective, have to kind of banish this pre-Islamic barbarist view in the world, that they have to banish it. So they're kind of anti-modernity, they're kind of anti-enlightenment, they're very hostile to the idea of the nation state, generally speaking, anti-democracy, identitarian, completely hostile to any kind of opposition. So I see Islamism as a kind of totalitarian movement, so akin to Nazism and Stalinism in terms of, obviously the ideas are not expressed in exactly the same way, but wanting to have that kind of total control over society. And for them, Jews are central to their worldview. They see Jews as being the main opponents in trying to create this kind of global Islamic order. Right. And so anti-Semitism is very central to Islamism, to the Islamist worldview. And you can see that if you read their literature, some of which is translated into English. So I see Islamism as a totalitarian movement, inherently anti-Semitic, genocidally anti-Semitic, but very different from Islam as a religion. And as I say, they see themselves as true Muslims and are very, very hostile to other Muslims who don't go along with their view. They don't see them as really authentic kind of Muslims.
How widespread is it? Do you have any figures?
I think it's quite hard to have figures. I wish I could find figures, but I think it's certainly a minority movement worldwide within the Muslim community. But it's quite hard, partly because they try to, they're covert in the way that they operate. So they believe, it's quite the whole history of it is fascinating and quite strange, because at least organisationally, they model themselves on kind of Leninist type movements. Mm. Obviously, their ideas in important respects are different, but they believe in having a kind of vanguard party, so a kind of party of professional revolutionaries, which operates covertly and then has people who support what they do. So it's quite hard to give accurate figures. So certainly a minority among Muslims, probably in a lot of countries, quite a small minority, but a very loud and aggressive minority, and one that is quite willing in many circumstances to use violence against their opponents.
You know, I talked to someone who works in anti-terror law enforcement, and they were saying 80% of their workload is dealing with Islamist stuff. I mean, do you think Britain, British public and the mainstream Muslim community understand how big of a threat this is?
I think there's a problem that the threat is played down, and that partly relates to the kind of identitarian world perspective, because if you think, well, Muslims are inherently oppressed and these people are Muslims and therefore we can't talk about it, so there's a tendency to talk it down. So when there's a terrorist atrocity, for example, the kind of Manchester Arena is one that springs to mind in Britain, although you have examples all over Europe, very often they tend to be played down. But also, I don't think people understand the nature of the movement. So among Islamists, you have the kind of jihadis, who are the people who are willing themselves to use violence. And they're a small minority, obviously a very dangerous one, but a small minority. And then you have what some people call institutional Islamists. Some people use the term participationist Islamists. And they are people who support violence in principle, but themselves do not engage in violence. They often will stand in elections, or they'll be involved in non-violent political movements. And often that seems a distinction between the kind of extremists and the moderates. But that's a bit misleading, because although you could say extremist, moderate, because some use violence and some don't, but they both subscribe to the same extreme set of ideas. So in that sense, they're all extreme in terms of their arguments. And you see it very much, I mean, going back to the whole debate about Israel and Hamas and the Palestinians, a lot of the groups organising the marches, the kind of anti-Israel marches that we've seen in London and other places in Europe and America and so on, are Islamists, are the so-called institutional Islamists. So Islamists who will not themselves as individuals engage in violence, but they will support violence and they give support to violence. So I think we shouldn't just see the problem in narrow terms of violence. But violence is a real problem and it should be tackled. So I'm not saying be soft on it, but I think it's important to understand the broader context of the whole thing as well.
So you were saying they're not really loyal to the nation state. Is this a worldwide problem, and is Iran behind it, would you say?
I think it's, well, among Islamists, it's a kind of, they're very, very sceptical and cynical of the nation state, yeah. And Iran, well, certainly Iran plays quite a big role. Right. And Iran itself, I mean, obviously you have Iran itself is a nation state, so it gets a kind of a bit ambivalent. But even Iran sees itself not just as Iran, but having a right to expand in the region, have a kind of expand beyond its borders and take control of, or certainly influence what's happening in the kind of like small Gulf states around it. So I think it's a problem. And it's also very interesting to think about the overlap between Islamism and identity politics, because the identitarians too are very sceptical of the nation states. Right. So they'll say, I mean, we're sitting in Britain, so I'm using the British example, but you could use German or American or whatever examples where people who subscribe to that kind of politics are very cynical about the nation state, very cynical, for example, about the citizens of a state having control over migration and its borders, kind of calling for open borders, criticising people who say, no, I want national control over borders. So the kind of Islamists and the so-called woke movement, they're not identical, there are differences. But there's also a lot of overlap between them in terms of anti-modernity, anti-enlightenment, anti-democratic, and also this kind of trans-national kind of ideology.
And finally, if people want to find out more, where can they go?
Well, the best way is to look at my website, the Radicalism of Fools website, which is www.radicalismoffools.com, and you can subscribe, get more information. I try and update it as much as I can. When I have articles in the media, or hopefully this video as well, I'll kind of put a link to it on the website. So that's the best way to find out what I'm saying.
Daniel Benamy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.